Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to the 11th episode of the CalcioLand podcast. As usual, I want to thank you for your tremendous support. If you enjoy what you hear, please leave us a review. Tell your friends. We're really developing this podcast quite well, thanks to your support. So I'm going to take you back to our preview episode where I kind of gave a mission statement on what this podcast is going to be and what makes it a little bit different. I've always been a big fan of Bill Simmons. He's my favorite writer. I loved about him that he combined pop culture and sports. So on this episode, I have a great guest coming on, Andrew Barker, who writes for Variety Magazine. He's a big Inter fan, so we're going to talk about that. But he's also a film and music critic, so we got into that quite a bit. But just like on Twitter, I don't believe in clickbait, so I don't want you guys to feel deceived in any way. So we're going to start with football for quite a while. Once you start hearing the words Chris Cornell, if you're not interested in music and film, that's your, you know, that's your signal that you should drop off. So I'm joined by my excellent producer and great friend, Alex Goldberg, who's here with me. Did you enjoy that interview we did with Andrew, by the way?
Very much, very much. And for anybody that is into the music and film, they'll also really love it.
Fantastic. So this week, you know, one thing that I often like to say is that I don't put really any credence at all in public statements made about transfers. You know, just last summer, Pogba, 2 days before getting on that plane to go to Manchester with the Pogba back hashtag, all that started. Two friends of mine in New York who are going to be eventually on the podcast, you know, met him in person and they got him to say on the record that he was staying at Juve. 2 days later, he gets on the plane and signs with Manchester United. And, you know, I've seen that over and over again. But this week, Diego Costa made some statements that I have to say really surprised me. And, you know, in a way, he made me look bad because, you know, for the past few weeks, I've been saying, yeah, there's a good chance he extends with Chelsea. Chelsea would like to keep him. But he basically said that Conte texted him and said he's no longer part of the plans at the club. So, Alex, you're a big Chelsea fan. So tell me a little bit, what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, I was shocked, too, just because Diego Costa, to my knowledge, really doesn't speak in any language that people fully understand. So seeing those quotes, first of all, on Twitter, I was like, he actually said that. But honestly, as a Chelsea fan, even though he's been a great player, great striker, has won 2 Premier League titles with Chelsea in 3 years, a little bit of relief, David, to be honest, because, you know, right when Antonio Conte was appointed manager, I did wonder, is he going to be able to get through to Costa? You know, Costa's always on his own page in his own world. Even if he is playing great, it almost is just like, let him run wild and see what happens. But long term, I feel like Diego Costa doesn't fit with Chelsea. And if he does, if he doesn't, I always have to hear about, is Diego Costa leaving? Is he going? Is he going back to Atletico Madrid? So a little bit of relief, honestly, because now I'm just kind of thinking, who is the next Chelsea striker? Is it Lukaku? Is it somebody else? I don't know. But assuming Costa, what he said was true, as you were alluding to, saying that he's not part of Conte's plans, I really do feel a little bit relieved. So you're more knowledgeable here. What do you think will happen with Costa?
So, again, I'm reeling from those statements, and I appreciated your insight with that. So, look, this is what we know about Costa. In January, he was very close to going to China, had a huge offer. I had a feeling right away he wasn't going to leave with the title so close and him being so important to the team. Since then, you know, the tax code in China has changed. It's a lot harder for a player to go there. Cannavaro's club was very interested in signing him. I'm interested to see if they try again now. The other options, Atletico Madrid, you know, I have a feeling that that's one of the reasons that Conte told him, look, you know, you love Atletico so much, you can go there, because Conte is all about the group, doesn't care about the individual. If he feels that someone is putting themselves above the group, he's like, yeah, I don't care if you're good, I'll find someone else. So I don't know if there's a connection with Atletico, but the transfer ban like really adds a huge wrinkle to that. So Atletico wouldn't be able to sign him until January. It's kind of hard to imagine that he's going to stay till January at Chelsea, you know, kind of frozen out. It's kind of, they wouldn't risk an injury with a big transfer fee. So it's a complicated situation. The other option is Milan, and that's a very intriguing one. So, you know, he works with Jorge Mendes. I don't know if he's exactly his agent, but he works a lot with him. Mendes got to know the Milan owners. There's going to be some meetings there. So he could be a very intriguing option for Milan. The cost would be huge, both wages, transfer fee-wise as well. So this is going to be a very interesting situation with Diego Costa in the next few weeks. And I'm very curious to see what the reports are going to look like coming up.
All right. Well, this is the $1 billion question if you're a Chelsea fan. Who do you think will replace him at Chelsea?
Well, I think the obvious answer is Lukaku. I think that's what makes the most sense. He's been linked to Chelsea a lot of times for a while. You know, Manchester United, too, could be an option. They've done a lot of deals with his agent, Raiola. But to me, they are much more focused on Morata and potentially Belotti as well. So I think Lukaku will be the main guy. And I think Chelsea's looking at another option as well. I have a feeling they could go for both. And that's Celtic striker Moussa Dembélé, who would be a very intriguing player for the future as well. Another player that's been linked to Milan as well. But Chelsea is going full steam ahead for him. So it wouldn't surprise me, especially if they get a huge return for Diego Costa, that they sign both players. So now that we got the intro out of the way, let's get to your questions. And again, this is my favorite part of the show because I love interacting with you guys. And you guys, you know, Alex and I put in a lot of work, but you guys are really the secret sauce of the show between promoting it and between giving us great questions to discuss on the podcast. So, Alex, which ones did you pick for today?
All right, well, let's start with the tattooed man himself. What are the odds that Nainggolan leaves Roma this summer?
So this week there were some quotes that Nainggolan gave, and I think they were very cherry-picked. I think the translations were a little bit loose on him potentially leaving. You look at all the changes at Roma, Totti leaving, Salah potentially leaving, Rudiger potentially going to Inter. Nainggolan, you know, loves Rome. He's talked about the sunshine in Rome and how he'd go to the Premier League only if there was the sunshine in Rome. So I think he's going to stay. Roma, too, is going to make it worth his while. They're going to offer him a huge new contract, close to what Chelsea was offering him next summer. So, you know, look, it's a long summer. A lot of things can change. I can't blame any club for wanting Nainggolan. To me, with Hamsik, he's probably been the best midfielder in Serie A the past few years. But at the end of the day, I still would be very surprised if he left.
Okay. Do you think Suso would be a good fit at Roma if Mohamed Salah leaves? And how would Milan replace him, considering he was one of their best players?
So Suso's an interesting situation. This is one time where maybe the change in ownership might a little bit come back to bite Milan. And I'll get into it. I don't think it'll really hurt him. I actually think Milan might be better regardless. So when Galliani was still there, he would have basically an agreement with Suso for an extension. His contract expires in 2019. Not huge urgency, but, you know, he really needs a raise. I thought he was really the best, after Buenaventura's injury, the most consistent player on Milan for the season. So that situation is getting interesting. If Roma loses Salah to Liverpool, which is, I still think there's a good chance that happens, they'd love to have Suso. So it's going to be interesting to see what Milan does. They probably could get a very good return for Suso that they could reinvest in other positions. Milan's been heavily linked to Kita Balde. And look, as much as I like Suso, I'd much rather have Kita Balde. I always say the standard that I have for Milan, Inter, other clubs trying to get back to the Champions League is, are the players that they're buying, would they be starters on the teams that they're trying to surpass? Kita Balde would. I'm not so sure that Suso would. He'd be a good replacement if he goes to Roma. Keep in mind, Roma has pretty good depth. They have El Shaarawy, Perotti, Dzeko. If Suso goes there, he'd kind of be in the rotation with them. If he goes, Milan, you know, assuming they sign Kita, they're competing with Juve. They'd have Bonaventura as well. Niang came back from Watford. Maybe he'd be involved in a deal. The other player for Milan is De La Fu, who I thought was really, really good for them. Barcelona has that option to buy him back from Everton. They're definitely going to exercise it because it's well below his market value. But Delafu wouldn't mind staying at Milan with the World Cup coming. He knows he'd be a starter there at Barcelona. He certainly wouldn't. So let's see what happens there. Although Suso's been very good for Milan, they've also signed him for free. So they could make a very nice profit on that one. I think Milan fans could still be optimistic even if Suso leaves.
Okay. David, what do you make of the Vecino-Inter rumors?
So I think for a lot of Inter fans, this wasn't a very sexy name when you heard that. But, you know, I think Inter, the sexy signings a lot of times have really come back to bite them. So Vecino is a player who's been at Fiorentina for a while. Inter's new manager, Spalletti, has always liked him, tried to bring him to Roma. Vecino has also been linked to Juve. And, you know, Juve knows what they're doing on the transfer market. A few years ago, they were interested in using the exit clause that he has that has since expired. So I think that makes a lot of sense for Inter to go for him. I think he'd fit in pretty well for them. Spalletti would like to get his teammate Borja Valero from Fiorentina. He's a tremendous player, but he's older. Ownership at Inter, you know, would rather have a younger player than Borja Valero. So I think Vecino would be a pretty intriguing option for Inter.
Okay, this pertains to my team. Do you see defensive midfielder Nemanja Matic joining Juventus?
I have to tell you, I feel that all the people that trash Matic should maybe learn a little bit more about football. Like, the guy is a very good player. The fact that Juve really wants him and the fact that Conte was dead set on keeping him already tells you a lot that he's a quality player. So Matic often goes to Italy shopping, enjoying the great life in Italy. Juve has always liked him. I think the takeaway from the final in Cardiff is that they need to improve that midfield. But I think Conte is not going to let him leave, especially now that they're back in the Champions League. So I think for Juve, there's been a very fluid situation in the midfield. They were linked to two other players, and I think our Premier League fan listeners are going to be intrigued by this. The two main midfielders that Juve was looking at were Tolisso and Fabinho. Some people have linked Tolisso to Chelsea. It wouldn't surprise me. That hasn't been done at our end, but again, we don't cover the PL full-time. Could very well be. Fabinho's been linked to Monaco. There's less momentum for Juve to sign him. The player they really want is Nzonzi, who I think would be a tremendous addition for Juve. Another player they see as a good option, more of a value, would be Emre Can from Liverpool, because he has just 1 year left on his contract. So I don't see Matic going to Juve. I think they're going to go full steam ahead for Nzonzi, who I think would be a very intriguing addition for them.
And Nzonzi had a great year at Sevilla. All right, moving on. Which Serie A player could you see lighting up the Premier League?
So look, I'm a Serie A fanboy, but there's no denying that the vast majority of players that went from Serie A to the Premier League have flopped. I think Serie A clubs have been very shrewd and then bringing back those same players for a fraction of the cost back to Italy with very good results. So aside from Gabbiadini, who was very good, I think Premier League clubs, if they shop in Italy, should focus more on defense. You look at Andrea Ranocchia, who in Italy has a horrible reputation despite having been a great prospect. He did quite well in the Premier League. So I think the clubs there need to smarten up and look at center backs. And, you know, De Vrij, who's at Lazio, would be a great addition. At Roma, we have Manolas and Rudiger, who would be terrific additions for anyone in the Premier League. And then the guy who I really would go all out, and your club has certainly tried in the past, is Koulibaly at Napoli. You know, interestingly, a lot of people that maybe don't watch Serie A, they watch Koulibaly against Real Madrid and are like, what's all the hype on this guy? Like, this guy sucks. Guess what? Real Madrid made Bonucci, Chiellini, and Barzagli look really bad. So maybe think again. Koulibaly is legit. A really, really good player. You know, aside from the ones on Juve, he'd be my pick as the best center back. I don't know how much Napoli would be willing to consider an offer. He's really their only consistently good center back. But those are the types of players that I would look at.
Yeah, I think he's a beast, Koulibaly. Okay, last one. What about Mauro Icardi? How come we don't see more transfer rumors about him?
So on our episode on Thursday, we talked about Belotti's exit clause, and I tried to really like explain the way that exit clause works. Now, Icardi has a similar one, which is an exit clause for 110 million, so 10 million more than Belotti, that's valid only abroad. To me, Belotti, that exit clause is just a clause for him not to go to Juve. For Icardi, that clause is also for Napoli, who tried really hard to sign him last summer, and other teams in Italy. Granted, unless Napoli sells a lot of players, they can't afford him anyway. But the reason you don't see transfer rumors with Icardi is I think clubs just know that he has no desire to leave Inter. He has a lot of personal reasons to stay there. He certainly had opportunities to leave that club in previous seasons. He's gotten two big raises back-to-back years. I think with Spalletti, he could be sensational. Just look at what Spalletti did with Dzeko. So the reason you don't see rumors about Icardi is I think clubs just know he won't leave. Inter has probably the biggest financial resources of any club in Italy. Last year, net of sales, they considerably outspent Juve. So that's the reason why you don't see him linked to other teams. So here we are for my favorite part of the podcast, which is always interviewing guests, because it's a great opportunity for me to catch up with friends of mine, an opportunity for me to learn new things. And usually if I'm learning something, the hope is that the people listening are learning as well. So I like to always say that I'm a failed film and music critic who is pretending to be a football pundit. So today I'm joined by actually a music and film critic. I like to say that, you know, a lot of rappers want to be NBA players, and I want to be this guy. So I'm excited to have my good friend Andrew Barker joining us on the podcast. He's a film and music critic, a senior features writer at Variety magazine, also the author of the book Bizarre Ride to the Far Side. He's also a big Inter fan, so we're going to talk about that up front, and then we're going to get into some music and some film stuff. I don't like to clickbait, so if you're not interested in that stuff, once you start hearing the word Chris Cornell, you can tune off and we won't be offended, but we're going to have a good time with that. Before I have Andrew come on, I want to tell you a little bit about what Variety magazine actually is all about, because some of our listeners outside of the U.S. might not be familiar with it. So this is one of the most prestigious publications that cover pop culture entertainment in America. They actually have been around since 1905. 2 years later, they published what is considered to be the first film review of any kind. Such a groundbreaking publication that they came up with some terms that we take for granted, like a showbiz, sitcom, even striptease. And Martin Scorsese, probably one of my favorite directors, described Variety as the single most formidable trade publication ever. So after that introduction, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Calcioland.
Thanks so much for having me, David. Yeah, this is a thrill. I'm a fan of what you do, fan of the podcast, and I appreciate you having me on, because I know you have some really serious football writers on there, so I hope your listeners can put up with me.
No, I'm very excited, because, you know, Andrew, we always try to have, some different elements, too, and in our preview podcast, I always let it be known that on occasion we're going to get into music and film, but again, we want to do it in a way that if people aren't interested, they can just tune off. So we're going to start talking a little bit about Inter, because I know you're a big fan of them. We've been following each other and chatting on Twitter for quite some time, but I don't know how you became an Inter fan. So that's the first question I have for you. How did you pick this club to follow?
It was kind of a gradual process. I guess it goes back to when I was a real little kid. The World Cup was in the United States, and I actually lived maybe 15 miles away from Pasadena, where they had the final. And I was following along. I don't know how old I was, 8 maybe, maybe a little older. But Roberto Baggio just struck me immediately and became kind of one of my first real sports heroes just on that tournament alone, which got me interested in Italian football in general and just football, period. But being Southern California, pre-internet, without any sort of family connections to Italy, I didn't really have any way to follow along. But that, that interest kind of remained. And then you started kind of getting more Italian football around when I was in high school, when Ronaldo kind of hit. And so obviously I was interested in him, and that endeared me to Inter a little bit. But my Inter fandom really started when, you know, like a lot of Americans, I did a year abroad and living in Milan for a year. And so, yeah, so obviously I was interested in Ronaldo. And then I was living in an apartment with like this tiny one bedroom apartment with three Italian dudes. And they were all hardcore Juve fans. So me being a natural contrarian, I was like, okay, well, clearly I'm going to go for Inter here. And that ended up being a really interesting year to kind of get into them. I mean, they had a very good team. You know, that was the year after they had come within 45 minutes of winning the Scudetto.
Oh, yeah.
Blow it in typically Inter fashion. And then that year, you know, they went out in the semifinals of the Champions League to Milan, of all teams, and threw away goals, of all things. So it was just like, it really endeared them to me because they were like this team that was defined by this noble and almost like cosmic sense of utter last second failure. Mm-hmm. You know, that they were just almost good and they would somehow just destroy themselves completely. And so that whole, you know, pazza interamala kind of a philosophy, it kind of stuck with me. And then, this from there over the years, my first year fandom just kind of snowballed and became a obsession to the point where waking up at 6 a.m. to watch a crappy Russian stream of Inter became a weekly part of my schedule.
Hey, and you're on the West Coast, so that's even earlier than us here on the East Coast. So great. So you mentioned Pazza Inter, you know, it's crazy Inter. That's their nickname. You know, they even this year with Pioli, when everything seemed well on their way, they completely self-destructed. So since you cover music and films, is there either a band or a movie or even a TV series that you think best describes the Inter that you've been following since you've been, you know, like a young guy?
You know, you mentioned this to me earlier, and I was really thinking about it. And I don't know that there's a one movie that can really encompass just the horrific psychodrama of Inter fandom. But I think of a couple individual scenes. Like so Inter from like 2011, 2012 up until 2015, 2016. I think of that scene in The Big Lebowski, where the dude has just got his car back, right, from the impound.
Yeah.
And he's driving home, he's listening to Creedence, he's smoking a joint and drinking a beer all simultaneously. He's feeling good, he's sort of pounding on the roof, everything's all right. And then he goes to throw his joint out the window without realizing that the window's rolled up. It bounces off the window onto his crotch starts burning, he screams, he pours the beer on his crotch, and in doing so loses control of the car and crashes into a bunch of trash cans. And that's pretty much every season past the treble, in the sense that, you know, it would start off, everyone was feeling pretty good. We're feeling like, all right, things could have gone better the last time, but things are looking up now. And we kind of don't realize the extent to which we're doing a bunch of bad things simultaneously. And then one thing goes wrong, and we freak out, and we try to compensate for that. And in compensating for it, we end up doing something else wrong, and before we know it, like, the car's in the ditch, and the season's over. So that's like the general gist of Inter fandom, I think. But I think this last season was different. I think it was a little more complicated. And the only thing I can think of that sums it up is that scene in that great first season episode of The Simpsons where Bart becomes a daredevil. And, you know, so he wants to jump over Springfield Gorge on his skateboard, right? And Homer arrives at the last second, and they have a talk, and they're crying, and they go, I love you too, son. And as everything seems to be ending, Homer starts rolling down the hill on the skateboard. He screams, he flies, he's going over the gorge, and all of a sudden he thinks, hey, oh my God, I'm going to make it. You know, this is the greatest feeling in the world. And then he drops out of the sky, and he falls down the gorge, and he hits every single rock on the way down. Then a helicopter comes, picks him back up, loads him into an ambulance. The ambulance hits a tree. The gurney flies out of the ambulance and goes down the hill again. Like, that's the only way I can describe it, because it was, you know, we started the summer just despondent, because all of a sudden, you know, the Mancini drama, he drops out. We had no idea what's going on. You know, we're Homer on the skateboard taking off on the ramp, thinking everything's going to be horrible. And then it kind of, we got the Suning money. We make a couple really big, splashy signings. We get this coach who, you know, has had some interesting success at Ajax. So it's like, maybe things are going to be okay. Utter catastrophe. Everything collapses. Pioli comes in, lifts us out of the ditch. We're still pretty beaten up. We're not feeling great, but it's like, okay, we're back on level ground here. Things are going to be okay. And then disaster strikes again, and we fall down the hill again. So it's a different kind of Inter, as opposed to like the last second cosmic tragic failure. I mean, this is just like a tragic comedy, I guess.
Absolutely. No, great description. So, you know, I'm a Giants fan in the NFL, and when I think, and you know, and I live in Boston, so the rivalry with the Patriots, the first Super Bowl that Eli Manning won against Brady was one of the best memories for me as a fan ever. And you know, to me, that Super Bowl was enough that I could have said, you know what, if Eli Manning throws an interception every pass the rest of his career and we never make the playoffs again, I still have that Super Bowl as a Giant fan in Boston, so it doesn't matter. I'll take the big triumph, even if it means with a lot of mediocrity. I'll take that over a lot of years of just going to the playoffs and not winning the big one. And, you know, I see a lot of parallels with Inter. You've been a fan for a while. I would imagine probably the highlight for you was when Inter won the treble with Mourinho. I'm sure you're probably, as an Inter fan, pretty happy that that Juve didn't match that in Cardiff just last weekend. So for you, was it worth winning that treble and then have to put up with all these crazy years, which quite frankly really have not been up to snuff for a club like Inter?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, you know, it's, I mean, if I'm going to be totally honest, yeah, when Juve crashed last weekend, there was a sense of relief. Okay, we're still the only treble winners. But then you think about it, and I mean, it's almost like, what would it be like? It's like laughing at some guy because Halle Berry broke up with him, you know, but you haven't been on a date in like 5 years. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, that guy had a bad day, but like, who are you to, you know, who are you to laugh at them here? But no, it's an interesting question about the treble, and I think especially relevant to Inter because, I mean, Moratti clearly had this obsession that was driving him to spend money like he did and to just be as occasionally reckless as he was, that he wanted to have this success. He wanted to do this before he passed the club on to whoever he's going to pass it on to. And he mortgaged a lot of Inter's future in doing so. You know, I mean, it's like you buy a Ferrari, but then you have to eat ramen noodles for a couple of years to pay it off. So, I mean, it always is a trade-off, but I do think it's worth it. I mean, not just because of how amazing that felt that year, but also just because it really puts a pin in that Inter cycle in the sense that, I mean, like imagine if in 2009, 2010, Inter had just, you know, won the Scudetto again, as had become normal for them at the time, and had gotten bounced out of the Champions League, as was normal for them at the time. How would that Inter team be remembered in the wide scope of cultural history, you know? Like, they might be remembered as, like, kind of this weird period post-Calciopoli, where, you know, all of Inter's main rivals were kind of handicapped, and so they won the league, but it's kind of this weird little asterisk. Or they might have been remembered like almost just as Zlatan Ibrahimovic's team, you know what I mean? Like that he led this Inter team to all these titles and then left and then Inter went nowhere. So I think the fact that we can at least point to that as this highlight point where there was an actual legitimate team that did something worthy of being stacked next to the Grande Inter periods, I do think it was worth it. But it's, I mean, the trade-off is very real, and we've been all living through it for, what, 6-7 years now.
I love that analogy of the Ferrari and the ramen noodles. Yeah, I kind of agree with you. Moratti basically put it all on the credit card, and then the payments came due, and the party ended. But yeah, I'm with you. To me, that's still worth it, because a team that wins a treble obviously goes down in history, and as a fan, you'll always have that. So that's great. So there's been a lot of changes, obviously, at Inter since then. Moratti's gone. We have these Chinese owners with deep pockets. You know, you can definitely question the way they've spent the money, but they've certainly invested a lot in the team. How optimistic are you? You know, now Spalletti, Sabatini on board, which I think were really good hires, especially in Serie A in the short term. But how do you see Inter in the next few years?
I mean, that's another good question. And honestly, I feel I've never felt less qualified to imagine what on earth is going to happen with Inter next season than I do right now. I think Spalletti's a great hire. I mean, you know, if you believe the Gazzetta and the Corriere, you know, he's maybe their third choice after Cholo and Conte. But I didn't honestly think either of those guys would come to Inter. I mean, why would they at this point? So for what Inter could have done, I think Spalletti's a great hire, Sabatini as well. But I don't know, man. I mean, like, honestly, like who is going to be lining up in defense for Inter next year? I mean, I'm sure D'Ambrosio will still be there. Will he be a starter? I have no idea. I mean, it's completely up in the air how much they want to tear down this team, because there are so many individual elements of this team that it seems like you could build a squad around. But who? I mean, what have you heard about Inter's defense? Because past transfer windows have kind of ignored that glaring deficiency in our squad. And right now, I mean, who's worthy of starting in a Champions League caliber team that's on Inter right now? Murillo could be gone. He had a kind of a disaster of a second half.
Yeah.
Miranda's showing his age. Andreoli, you know, I have a sentimental attachment to him, but I don't think anyone sees him as starting material. And,
yeah.
And God forbid we get into the fullbacks. I mean, Nagatomo has barely been a footballer for the last couple of years, and Ansaldi didn't work. D'Ambrosio, I mean, God love the guy. He's really improved. He was one of the few Inter players to legitimately improve this year, but he's still not anyone that anyone would consider world-class or, you know, a starting player in a Scudetto-winning team. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty there. And, I mean, I've heard a couple names thrown out, but, I mean, I thought Rodriguez was supposed to sign for Inter, and clearly he just posed in a red and black shirt. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, so I really appreciate your insight on Inter. So, guys, for you, those of you that aren't into music and films, this is your cue. I don't want you to feel misled. So now we get into my favorite part of the podcast, because now I get to learn a lot, because, like I said, I'd love to trade places with Andrew's job. So we get to do some insight in music, starting with Chris Cornell. So on the day that I found out that Chris Cornell died, I contacted Andrew right away to see if he wanted to come on the podcast. That day, you had to do a review for Pirates of the Caribbean. So here we are today, catching up to that. So I can tell you that death really surprised me, the fashion of it, too. You know, I remember hearing, it was just the year before, Scott Weiland, you know, passing away. And, you know, unfortunately, that one didn't surprise me at all, sadly. Another great talent, but definitely very self-destructive. Chris Cornell seemed like a very even-keeled guy. I'd seen Soundgarden's reunion shows 3 times in the past few years. You read his interviews. He seemed, you know, really in a good space. So tell me what, you know, when you found out, what was your reaction? And then when you found out that it was a suicide?
I mean, yeah, like you, I was legitimately shocked. I mean, you know, I remember how I felt learning of Prince's death, which gobsmacked me as well. But for some reason, this one just, I mean, I just remember waking up and, you know, checking Twitter while I was feeding my kid and just being like, wait, what? Why is everyone talking about Chris Cornell? This is weird. It just seemed particularly bizarre and out of nowhere. I mean, like you, you know, I saw him on some of his solo shows, and he just seemed to be transitioning so well into the idea of just being a middle-aged rock star. And a lot of people don't make that transition well, but he seemed to have everything kind of figured out and know where he kind of stood in the scheme of things. I mean, obviously none of us know what he's going through personally, But yeah, that shocked me as well. And I mean, yeah, and especially the manner of it. You know, I mean, this is kind of morbid, but I have a very distinct memory of, as a little kid, saving up my lunch money for several weeks just to go buy a cassette copy of Super Unknown. And finally got it. You know, I've been kind of pining for it for weeks, and brought it home, and I was just about to put it in the tape player when on the radio on K-Rock, they broke in to say Kurt Cobain had died.
Wow.
So it was kind of like, so though that album and that day and that death have always been sort of weirdly conflated in my mind. So that really, yeah, it's just, it's horrible. It's tragic. I mean, and you can hear it in some of the songs that, I mean, this is a, you know, you don't write a song like Fell on Black Days if you're, you know, not intimately familiar with what depression feels like,
sure.
You know, honestly. But still, it's horrible. It threw me.
Yeah, I have a great answer. And yeah, I'm still shocked over the whole thing. So the reason I got into Soundgarden, and I think I'm a little bit older than you based on what you described. The first concert I ever went to was Guns N' Roses back in 91 when they were touring Europe after Use Your Illusion. And they had two opening bands. They had Faith No More, who I was very familiar with. And then they had Soundgarden as an opening band. So, you know, at the time, this was well before YouTube, well before all the internet. So I went and bought Bad Motor Finger because I wanted to kind of be familiar with them. And I was really impressed with that album. And, you know, then I went to the show and, you know, they were the opening band, first band out. It was still, you know, full daylight. He comes out with the long hair, looking like Jesus Christ, like screaming like a maniac. And ever since, I've been a fan. So, you know, you talked about Saving Up to Buy Super Unknown, which is the album that came out after Bad Motorfinger. So tell me a little bit, you know, kind of when how you first heard of him. And then I'm curious to see, you know a lot about rock music, kind of where you rank him amongst the singers that you've been following as a fan and as a journalist.
You know, I mean, I couldn't, I'm sure the first time I ever heard him was probably, you know, either Outshined or Rusty Cage on the radio. But I have a very distinct memory of hearing Jesus Christ Pose on the radio for the first time. And just not, I mean, for one, that was easily at the time the heaviest song I'd ever heard in my life. But more than that, it didn't sound like any music I'd heard before. I mean, you know, now that, I mean, I didn't think of it in this way at the time, but looking back, I mean, it was almost like my first experience of atonality in music. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, it's not Schoenberg or John Cale or anything, but it's the idea that you can go really far outside of just normal major minor sort of pop song structures, but still make something that's melodically coherent, but that just sounds so alien and just so messed up, but in a way that makes sense. So that song left a real impression on me, and it really kind of, I think, in retrospect, steered me down a lot of more interesting directions as far as kind of seeking out, you know, I mean, not just metal, but just kind of more experimental outsider music in general. That's my first real distinct memory of Soundgarden's music. As far as where I rank him as a singer, I mean, you know, you don't want to get too hyperbolic, but I think he really was one of the last great rock and roll singers and rock and roll frontmen of the rock and roll era. I mean, because that's, I mean, do you see like anyone taking that mantle and being, like you said, the guy who looks like, you know, sexy shirtless Jesus out there singing like God, and being in the biggest band on earth? You know, I don't know. I mean, what would someone with his talent and his presence be doing today? I mean, would they be in a band like Soundgarden? It's hard to say. So I think he channeled a lot of different strands of rock music that were already pretty established then. I mean, you hear so much Robert Plant in his voice.
Yeah,
you hear so much Ozzy. I mean, you listen to a song like Seasons off the single soundtrack. I mean, that's like, that's almost like the last great modern blues song. You know what I'm saying? So he was dealing with these very kind of archetypal elements in his music. But at the time, it was something that sounded 100% modern. There was nothing retro about it. It absolutely fit the 90s. And anyone you hear today who's making music like that, you're going to think of them as kind of a throwback act, you know? So I think he really was last of a breed, and that makes it even worse to think of him being gone.
Absolutely. So, you know, the grunge genre, you know, dominated the early 90s. Soundgarden were really the first band to kind of start all that. Pearl Jam, Nirvana, all that came after them. And to me, you know, as you mentioned, you could really describe Soundgarden more as a heavy metal band that just happened to be from Seattle and then got taken into that scene. And I'm here in the studio wearing my Bad Motorfinger t-shirt for this podcast. It's one of my favorite albums ever. You know, I think a lot of people think of Chris Cornell as this great singer, but this guy also wrote so many amazing guitar riffs as well. That album, to me, I can't think of that many albums that have more great guitar riffs. Do you kind of see it the same way as well?
Bad Motorfinger is an all-timer, man, for sure. I mean, the only, you know, trying to think of what compares, I mean, I'd say maybe, you know, Sabbath, Masked Reality, Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak, Master of Puppets, I guess. I don't know. Maybe if you like combine the first three Queens of the Stone Age records, you have the same density of great guitar riffs. But I mean, it's in the top five there for sure. I mean, even in the, I mean, God, that's such a good record. You like even the kind of like semi obscure like side B deep cuts on there. You know, like Room a Thousand Years Wide or Mind Riot or Holy Water. I mean, those would be the first song of the album on so many bands' records. So it's an all-timer for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's transition a little bit to movies as well, because this is something that you cover as well. And I can't tell you how excited I was for our conversation on Rock. My head's about to explode that this is on my podcast, to be honest. So let's transition a little bit to movies. I know you've been writing a lot of reviews on this. So this is the summer. This is the period of the blockbusters, the movies that appeal to younger people. So tell us a little bit about what big movies you would recommend. Please maybe pick some longer movies where Manchester United or Chelsea fans can go for a long time and they don't ask me transfer questions for like two more hours or so. So tell me a little bit about which big blockbusters we should look forward to this summer.
Okay, well, thinking of long, few people make long movies more consistently than Christopher Nolan, and I haven't seen it yet. But you know, he's making Dunkirk, and then you've got Catherine Bigelow making Detroit, which is really interesting because I think of those two as being, you know, those two directors really. I mean, they're driving the conversation as far as what an intelligent big budget studio blockbuster can be. I mean, Catherine Bigelow, you know, she's not making Point Break anymore, obviously. You know, she's getting more political with Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. But still, just the idea that there are filmmakers of that sophistication who have these, like, real summer release dates and are both making movies about real events. You know, Detroit is about the 1967 Detroit riots, and Dunkirk is obviously about the World War II evacuation of Dunkirk. I mean, those are right at the top of my list as far as movies this summer. Because, I mean, yeah, like, you know, we're going to have another Transformers movie, and we're going to have a Despicable Me movie, and we're going to have a Spider-Man movie, and they're going to make $1 billion, even though probably no one's really going to like them. But these are the kind of things that you kind of live for in the summer, where just the all-out spectacle, you know, three-hour-long movies that actually have weight and depth to them. So those are at the top of my list. And then... I mean, it is a sequel, but the War for the Planet of the Apes is, I think what they've done with that franchise is really miles ahead of all of these endless and kind of mercenary studio reboots. Those last two movies, both by the same director, were, I thought, at the absolute top of the heap as far as intelligent summer popcorn entertainment goes. So I'm really looking forward to that one. And then a little bit lighter on the scale, this is one I've actually seen at South by Southwest earlier, Baby Driver, which is this Edgar Wright movie, which is really fun. It's, if you don't know, he's the director who did Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead and World's End.
Oh, yeah.
And he basically, I mean, I guess it's almost like an action musical, basically, because it's about this getaway driver who is, like, sort of has this mild Asperger's and, like, compiles these playlists for all of his jobs. So it's basically like a jukebox musical with an amazing soundtrack. Highly recommend that one. I mean, that's a little bit quirkier, but it should be getting a big worldwide release. Closer to home, Wonder Woman was good. Not a great movie, but a good movie, worth all the attention it's getting. And just me being a hip-hop guy, especially a 90s hip-hop guy, I'm going to see the All Eyes on Me next week.
Oh, that should be exciting! Yeah, you think it's going to be as good as Straight Outta Compton? Comparable to that, you think?
I'm skeptical because Straight Outta Compton had a lot more going for it. I mean, that had F. Gary Gray, who's a director who, you know, has a real pedigree, and, you know, it had Universal behind it, so it had, like, some real, real money behind it. But I don't know. I know I'm very open-minded. I think that the success of that movie convinced people to put a lot more resources and thought and care into this stuff. So I'm looking forward to that, but who knows? I haven't seen that one yet.
Very exciting. So let me ask you, I'm a little bit older. The summer movies that you described that got me excited for some of them, but can you tell us, preview a little bit, which movies we can expect to be nominated for the Oscars? You know, the Oscar season's around Christmas. Anything on your radar? Any early favorites that you can think of?
You know, I always... I'm always quite... you know, there's a lot of people here who almost... here at Variety, who almost do that as a full-time job, just keeping their eyes on all these awards. I've never been that great at predicting them, mostly because I can't really figure out how the Academy thinks, and they and I don't often see eye to eye. I mean, you know, you think about this time last year, there was that movie Birth of a Nation, which everyone had assumed was going to win big at the Oscars. And then, of course, the director became involved in this really ugly scandal, and the movie wasn't actually particularly great, and it went nowhere. So, you know, I'm always hesitant to project too much. One movie, though, that played Sundance that's coming out later in the summer called The Big Sick, I would definitely want to call a little attention to. I know that's getting a wide release. It's a comedy. I mean, it's a comedy with some really serious themes in it. It's by written and starring Kumail Nanjiani, mm-hmm. who is he's a stand-up comic. He's in Silicon Valley, and it's sort of loosely based on his own experience as a, you know, adjusting to American culture as someone from a Pakistani background and marrying a white woman who then has health problems. So it's a really pretty wonderful movie. I would think it's going to be in the Oscar conversation, but if it's not, people should absolutely check that out because it's pretty special.
Fantastic. So the last question I have, Andrew, is obviously this is something a lot of people have been talking about recently. It feels like, you know, between Sopranos, The Wire, shows like that, like, really have elevated the TV series as an art form that it's never been like before. And, you know, it feels like, that's really where film is going. Rather than 2-3 hour movies, people want to stretch out into long series. And right now I'm really getting into the new Twin Peaks with David Lynch, which just feels like, you know, a 20-hour David Lynch movie, which is incredible for me. Do you see movies maybe taking back the mantle as the highest form in film, or do you think TV series are just going to take this over long term?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Anytime that you have, you know, Martin Scorsese and Woody Allen and Nicole Kidman, you know, putting their time and energy into doing things for Netflix and HBO or what have you, I mean, it's clear that a paradigm has shifted and things have changed. I don't know. I'm pretty old school, though, honestly. I still think that there's a certain degree of perfection in telling a complete story in, you know, 90 to 120 minutes or however much you need. I think, as amazing and as wonderful as so much televisual storytelling has become, there's still an inherent kind of flaw in it, in that you have a financial obligation and imperative to keep things going. And storytelling, to me, has to be about beginning, middles, and ends. I mean, like, I remember watching Stranger Things on Netflix and thinking, like, that was a really well put together, you know, like, 6-hour series that told a story beginning to end. But of course, it was successful, so you're going to have a second season, and it's going to keep going until people get tired and start demanding too much money. So I think that that's an inherent advantage that film will always have over TV, as great as TV gets. But it's so, you know, I'm old school. I'm a movie guy, but I think it's clear that other people disagree with me. So you're definitely going to see more of the world's real great filmmakers and actors devoting their energy to this. I guess I'll just have to deal with it. So.
Well, Andrew, this was really incredible. I could talk to you for another 2 hours about this stuff. I really enjoyed this. I look forward to having you on maybe after the transfer window. We can get into maybe some more comparisons of teams in Serie A with rock albums or films. But I really want to thank you for coming on. I had a blast doing this, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be on our podcast.
You know, I really appreciate what you do with DiMarzio and with this podcast and on Twitter. I mean, I love the fact especially that you do cover the Premier League full time and can always confirm or deny other people's scoops. So that especially. So, but thanks for having me on, man. This is fun.